we welcome in author Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
Well, just doing what we do here, following your pursuits back on the stairs. You got the schedule squared away for the monument now?
You're on the stairs?
I've been doing some stairs, not at your level.
What is your level? What are we talking here?
Oh, you know, I found a set nearby that's got, I laughed because I think you, the stairs you did recently had 20 steps, right? And you did it like 100 times?
Yes.
Yeah. I found a set of stairs with 15 steps. And I did that 20 times, which I thought was a decent introduction to doing the stairs.
How did you feel at the end?
Actually, I felt pretty good. Winded. You know, I didn't run, but it was a fast walk, jog kind of a thing. But I enjoyed that. It was nice to get in a little something different to the workout.
How are those legs?
Tight the next morning, especially hamstrings, upper thighs. They knew they had done some work.
I see. Well, it's just give it some time with the routine, Kimball, and you will be, I don't know if you'll be a Zulu warrior of stairs, but you will be a Zulu apprentice of stairs at the very least. I'm very confident now.
Oh, I'll take that. I'm just following your lead like I do in so much here. Let's see. Let's follow your lead and talk about a number of topics this afternoon. First off, a wonderful parody. I really enjoyed A Warning to the Furious, a nice little parody of the work of M.R. James.
Yeah, I didn't enjoy this as much as I thought I would, but I could see how a technical boffin like yourself, a man behind the radio scenes with boom mics and all of that fun stuff and editing and wizardry in the studio, I could see how that would appeal to a technician like yourself. The setup is it's a documentary sort of undertaking about M.R. James and related to his story, A Warning to the Curious by people who really don't know anything about M.R. James. The women running this, it's their project. They really don't know the first thing about him, and the crew are kind of like a rent-a-crew, and they're just there to execute the orders of the director. And things go wrong. It's a bit Don Quixote-ish. But it's, I don't know if it would work to introduce someone to M.R. James. But I like anything really M.R. James related or adjacent. And I'm into him. And fortunately, we actually have a surprisingly large number of radio adaptations and readings out there. But this is the only mockumentary really as such that I'm aware of.
And they made the phrase, to me, she makes a full English sound awfully suggestive.
Yeah, that's an insider joke, I would say, for M.R. James people, because M.R. James was famously, well, within these circles, or infamously sort of repressed. We don't really know a lot about his romantic feelings, if he had any. He was an antiquarian and a scholar who was usually on his own. The only time he had much in the way of human contact was when the boys would roughhouse him and his colleagues and would grab each other by the genitals around Christmas time. I'm not making that up. It's real. That is how it went in Victorian and in Edwardian times at the old college. And so that's a bit tongue-in-cheek about that. And his narrators, or his main characters, his protagonists, are often stand-ins for James himself in a way, and they exude that same kind of repression. Repression is something you can exude, so that was kind of a clever in-joke for the hardcore Jamesian.
Now, when was this recorded?
Well, I don't know. This must have been fairly... no, it wasn't like terribly recent. I don't know. What would you say? 10, 15 years
ago? Yeah, it felt like that. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But it was well done. I enjoyed it a lot. It was great to go back. Oh, go. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You can tell like there's that sort of period. I almost want to put it like in somewhere, I don't know, maybe even like 20 years ago where we weren't as inundated as we are now with the phones. Like if you remember, even in the early seasons of Frasier, do you recall this? They had cell phones. But cell phones, Niles and Fraser did, but cell phones hadn't become this thing that was just all-encompassing.
Mm.
So this is in that sort of between times almost. And so I think that's why it works, because it's less annoying when it just becomes a kind of, I don't know, modern day technology thing. And not like it's old school bootleg the sound type technology, but I sort of like that late 90s, early 2000s aesthetic when you weren't overwhelmed with that sort of thing.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. I don't know that I had ever seen this documentary that I think aired originally on PBS back in the late 1980s, a three-parter that was just wonderful, Buster Keaton, A Hard Act to Follow.
I would say it's the best documentary, well, not just of Keaton, but any of the silent comedians. It is your go-to three-part series for Keaton. And I think Keaton is one of those artists who we have to put on that top shelf of American artists. I just don't mean like film stars or directors or actors or anything like that. I mean your Herman Melville, a Dylan, a Walt Whitman. I think that a Keaton goes up there on that kind of mantle with people like that. If you're going to explain our artistic history to someone, I always like the idea. Aliens are very useful. An alien comes down and an alien's like, oh, what are humans like morally? And like you could point them in this direction and show them like this person over here. And the alien would be like, well, why do they do that? And you're like, yeah, exactly. You get it. And I feel like Buster Keaton, like the general or Sherlock Jr., if you show that to an alien, they'd be like, oh, yeah, no, I get that too. That's I can see why people would have been into that. That is pretty amazing. So this has a lot of archival sound. And for people who don't know, well, I'm probably talking about no one who exists. Because if you know Buster Keaton's silent film, you are probably familiar with Buster Keaton's speaking voice. So if you're not, though, his speaking voice is at odds with that silky smoothness, wouldn't you say, that you see on the screen, that balletic grace that we get with the silent films. I mean, he's a premier. I would say that Buster Keaton is one of America's greatest athletes in its history. And we don't think of him that way, but to do what he did, Bo Jackson couldn't have been doing the stuff that Buster Keaton does. So this is something that I saw a long time ago. I've seen it many times since. It's a favorite of mine, almost like that Beatles documentary, The Complete Beatles. It has that same feel, that same kind of narration, and it's just high class in the definitive documentary for someone who deserves that sort of treatment.
I love the fact that so many of his contemporaries were a part of it, but then I especially love some of the later conversations with Keaton, and when he was doing one of his last projects. I think he was nearly 70 years old at the time, and he wanted to do a stunt. The director and the producer said, no, you can't do that. It's too dangerous. And Keaton was a little pissed off. Like, it's not dangerous. Nothing dangerous about that. And he still had that desire to do it the right way.
The stunts that Keaton did do, and I tend not to focus on them that much because that's almost like lowest common denominator, like low hanging fruit type of stuff, like almost the meathead appeal, like you'll believe he did that, kid. Whereas there's an elan and there's a grace to his artistry, but some of the stunts he did in service to that grace and elan, they are flummoxing now. The one with the house, it's like this sort of like Gordon Matta Clark before Gordon Matta Clark, the house falls and he goes through the window, the open window. And can you imagine if that was you standing there? Like, wouldn't you walk right into it? Like, you'd freak, right? You'd be like, ah! you'd be smashed. To hold your ground and just have the house. I don't think, like, people now, when they see those films, I believe that they think it's, like, CGI.
Right.
I think
right.
That's what people think. And it's not. That's the whole thing with I can't believe that anyone takes something like Avatar, like, seriously. Like, I can't. I know, like, society's so dumb, but I can't believe anyone would take that seriously. And you're looking at it, it's, like, so obviously fake. But when I look at something from Buster Keaton from 100 years ago, I don't think it's fake. Part of the reason I don't think it's fake is because it's not fake. That like was as real as it could be. And to execute some of these sequences, and he wasn't alone in doing that. Harold Lloyd was another one where it's like, what was your insurance like? Because every day you went to work and be like, all right, see your wife. Maybe I'll be back. Maybe I won't. You never know. Make it my film.
It was interesting. Now, did you see the Peter Bogdanovich documentary on Keaton?
Oh, from 2 or 3 years ago?
Yeah.
I remember seeing that.
I liked that, but and maybe it's because it was colored by the experiences that Bogdanovich had. To me, it was a sadder story. And in this film, this three-parter, I saw Keaton who just loved doing the work and whatever he was doing when he was supplying gags for other comics, when he was doing TV commercials to make ends meet. He seemed to enjoy whatever it was he was doing.
There is a bootleg put out by a company called Purple Chick called Songs the Beatles Gave Away. And they would write songs when they were together as the Beatles that they wouldn't necessarily record themselves. They have to demo them. And they'd give them to Peter and Gordon, just other artists like that. Because they could do it. They were that good at writing songs. Keaton was that good at writing gags. Fan Laurel was a bit like that, but not to the extent that Keaton was. And I think that we have to keep in mind, too, there has been a sea change. When I was really getting into cinema at 15, 16 years old, Keaton was second place by a comfortable margin to Charlie Chaplin. And he wasn't to me. I was thinking, what are people thinking that they have this tramp character? There's no comparison as a sophisticated artist. And Keaton has gone ahead of Chaplin by an even larger degree, I would say, in from my mid-20s now until the age I currently am. So he's been recognized as that. And that doesn't always happen, especially because we tend to be, in our society, such dumbasses who don't look back at anything and discover it or reevaluate it. I mean, there's a reason everyone, for instance, thinks that the Beatles' later music is their best music. It's not because it is. It isn't. It's because that is what is more easily accessible to them on docuseries or the radio, things of that nature, classic rock. So it's fortunate that Keaton has been able to get out of that quagmire, as it were, because when it switched from silent to sound, he did have a tough go of it. And if you think about Singing in the Rain, he really epitomizes that switch. You know how some of the characters are like left behind because that film documents, okay, we're not doing silent anymore, and you hear the screechy voice or whatever. He had the throat full of rock kind of voice, and that didn't really work.
No, although it's sounds like a lot of that was also due to the fact that he lost a measure of creative control after he left MGM. And so perhaps if he had been left to his own devices to make some of those films that had sound, it would have been a different result.
He had some projects he helmed, though, and he just was not in his, he just wasn't in his medium anymore. I mean, I feel like this can almost happen with, if you were the best composer of all time and you wrote symphonies presently, that would be difficult for you. You'd have to change everything. You'd have to change how we experience music, the kind of music that we seek out. And I'm not saying that like someone couldn't do it, but that's sort of the position that someone such as Buster Keaton was in at the end of the 1920s when sound hit. It, because there's a link between his silence and his grace. When you insert a voice, you efface the face. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Spoke so much through the expressions of his face. And you wouldn't be able to do that to the same degree with the camera hanging, lingering on your expressions if you were talking. It's not the same thing. It's totally different. It's like a different language. So now he was out of his natural kind of argot, and he was just among the rabble now. And it didn't work with that kind of elan and grace that was really his stock and trade.
From Buster Keaton to a wonderful film from 1949, The Window, that certainly served as perhaps some inspiration for my favorite movie of all time, Hitchcock's Rear Window. I had not seen this before. Wow, what a terrific movie, and one of the best child actor performances I can recall seeing from this young Bobby Driscoll.
Bobby Driscoll, difficult end. He dies like right around 40. So this is his heyday. And it's hot. He's 9 years old, and he is sleeping out on his parents, who don't spare the rod, by the way, Kimball.
Mm.
He's sleeping out on his parents' family's fire escape, and he witnesses this murder upstairs. The thing that I like is we're never told why a murder. It's a husband and a wife, and they kill a guy. We don't even know why the guy was there. We know nothing about that. I like that we're not told. We don't need to know. We can ruminate on that ourselves if we want. Was it some threesome gone awry? Was it he came home? Because they seem to like get along fine. So why was this guy there? Did he owe somebody money? Is it her brother? Like we have no idea. But he witnesses this, and it's a riff on the little boy who cried wolf because he's prone to telling stories. And that's really looked when I was a kid. That was like looked down upon too. And you would always have that sort of that fable quoted to you. But the little boy who cries wolf. I don't know if kids know that right now. And it was a film where, like, if you had a problem with your kid, you just beat them a little bit. It's fine. It's like they all joke about it. How about when they pull out next to the cop? So he's sort of like been kidnapped, and the husband and the wife, they have this boy, and they're in the back of a cab. He's screaming. The cop comes over, and they tell some story that, oh, he's acting up. He's where he's going to get killed when he gets home, and it's kind of like funny, ha ha ha. And the cop just breaks into this, like, sort of nostalgic stroll down memory lane about how his parents used to beat him, and there's nothing wrong with it. You notice, when I saw that cop, I thought, wow, Kimball could apply for the force and be rookie rich, because this dude's like 82. Kimball would be surprised. I thought you would enjoy that.
I enjoyed that, and his real parents, man, they're great. Barbara Hale, Della Street, from the Perry Mason series, and underappreciated actor. I love him and everything I've seen him in. Arthur Kennedy.
And I would say, right, he's in The Lusty Men, the Nicholas Ray film with Robert Mitchum, which I think is probably Ray's. Ray was a very uneven filmmaker, but I would say that that's probably his best film from 1952. I like the idea of the modern Western / noir. But I would say this about The Window. It is misascribed as noir, and this bothers me. I see every single picture with an element of crime from the 40s and 50s pretty much called noir. There are tenets that have to be in place for a film to meet the requirements of being a film noir. And this does not have any of them. It's almost like saying
there's no femme fatale, which to me is a must for a film noir.
There's that. You need a fatalism, right? An intense Dostoevskian fatalism to a film. It has to infect your soul with black mold for it to be film noir, is how I look at it. And there always has to be this moment, and you can isolate the moment, it's not hard, where the main character, the guy who's screwed, makes a decision that is going to just screw him all the way through until his death. But we can pinpoint that moment. Like, you know when Mitchum does it in Out of the Past. You know when it happens in Detour. Like, you know the moment when someone makes that decision. A good way to look at it is, if this was on TV, would it be film noir? Then that makes Dragnet film noir. And Dragnet wasn't film noir. This isn't film noir. And it always exasperates me that people just slap that label around. It has to be shot a certain way. It has to be shadowy. It has to be mostly at night. A lot of this plays out during the day under the bright sun. But it is this dry run version in one limited way. It's not like a direct lift of your favorite film, Rear Window. It's a good performance by a child actor. It's a believable family and like a dumpy, depressing, although much nicer than mine, apartment. And it's a perfectly serviceable film to kill an hour and 25 minutes or whatever it is.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. Very good. Let's move from there to some music, a 1992 live performance, extended performance of November Rain by Guns N' Roses.
This would be from Las Vegas, January 25th, off of the new Super Deluxe Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 box set. And Guns N' Roses really only had that first album in them, and then it's kind of a double album, but if you want to call this two albums. And then they were all done. They were sort of like Oasis that way. Oasis had the two albums, and they were great, and that was pretty much all you were going to get. Axl Rose would lose his voice, but they really branched out on Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, and then subsequently on the road, touring behind that album, where they got downright orchestral. And they had all these other voices, and this is a huge sort of set piece that they did, November Rain. It's interesting about Guns N' Roses because there's all the misogyny and the bad stuff like that, but they excel at tenderness, which is surprising. Sweet Child of Mine is just one of the most beautifully romantic songs. Schubert would listen to that and be like, "Ooh, yeah, that's a good one. You've really moved me. I can use that on my lady." It's tender, and this song has that line. We both know hearts can change, and it's so simple. It's like a Zen koan, though. It's so simple that no one says it. And when we have something so simple, seemingly, although not really, that no one says, it strikes a note of profundity. And there's a lot happening in this song, a lot of different parts, transitions. Slash's guitar solo, especially in the live version, what I really like about him as a player is you know it's him straight away every time. He has his own sound, which isn't to say it's limited. But his guitar solos, his best ones, and this is one of them, they tell a story. They take you a narrative place on their own. And the recently deceased Jeff Beck, he did that even in the short form. If you listen to Shapes of Things, that guitar solo, it's only a few bars, but it tells a story. And this is a longer story in a way, because it goes on for much longer than just a couple bars.
That's great. And it's not, you know, solos go, to me, it wasn't showy. It was just, man, that guy's got some licks. He can play. I thought that was great.
Yeah, I don't really know anyone that I listen to that I would say that the soloing is ostentatious or anything like that. I think that's more something that people think happens than actually does tend to happen, at least. And I listen, obviously, to like a lot of different people. I don't really hear that. Sometimes on tour with obscure bootlegs with Led Zeppelin, or there was a show in California in 1972. It's a good show. But Jimmy Page was supposedly trying to impress some fine young thing in the front row, and so he was like soloing for her. You know how that is, Kimball. And so there's that. But I find Slash to be a very tasteful. It might sound strange, heavy metal. I mean, Ritchie Blackmore was tasteful, but a very tasteful player. He was sincere in wanting to have a sound that was instantly associated with him. I think he was a consummate artist that way.
All right, finally, a question that you posed a couple of weeks ago. I've been thinking about it a lot. If you could hold any all-time record, National Hockey League, Major League Baseball, what would it be? I love that question.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this, too. I have some feelings on this, but I would think it's unlikely that we'd sync up just because it's such an esoteric question, but what do you have for baseball?
Well, baseball, I was torn because I played baseball. I was, you know, I was okay, so I had some skills that I could relate to, and I thought at first maybe something like the all-time walks record because I always had a pretty good eye. But then I looked at the walks leaders They were all really, really terrific hitters who also racked up a fair amount of intentional walks. Nobody was going to intentionally walk me. So I decided, because most people don't know who they are, I would like to be the career leader in fielding percentage at a position.
Okay, but I would say that might be a little misleading. Do you follow me?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Because a lot of guys have a very high fielding percentage because they have no range. So you could be like, it's like old cement legs Kimball at shortstop today.
He didn't get to many, but he didn't miss them if he got to them.
Yeah, but like if you were slick fielding Louis Aparicio, you know what I mean? Like those guys tended to have like more errors because they were getting the more balls. I've thrown out cumulative stats. For the most part, I'm not really into those anymore. I would say, if this would make me a cool guy, I'd be like, you know what I'm the all-time leader in? I would go with on-base percentage.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that would be great.
Because then, like, think about Ted Williams. His career on-base percentage was 48, which is basically half the time. What do you want to do? Like, when you're a kid, you want to get on base. You want to run around, right? So, like, half the time. He doesn't have to be sad. He doesn't have to be like, oh, that sucked. That at-bat didn't go well. Half the time in that sport, he could be like, this rocks. Here I am on first again. Oh, another double for me. What do you know? I mean, you just would be playing. You know what I mean? You'd be playing the game more. Like a lot of baseball spent on the bench, right?
Right.
No matter who you are, you'd be the guy who's on the bench the least, pretty much. I mean, you'd be the most baseball-y of all the baseball players.
Well, and you know that your guys would be like, man, Fleming's on base again. Can we not put him out there? Come on.
I think that's when you think about that, too, Williams is ahead of course, you have, like, Ferris Fane. I think he's, like, 12 all-time, which is awesome. But Williams is ahead of Ruth. I mean, so Ted Williams got so much bang for his baseball buck. Every time he came into that batter's box, a lot of times the counting stats, they matter for the Hall of Fame, of course, and everything like that. But it's also like that you've hung around for a long time, and it's not really an indication of anything other than you were able to just keep going for it. It doesn't mean you were the best at it. Sometimes you were the best at it. Like they can sync up. Like Wayne Gretzky was the best at passing. And he's the all-time assist leader. Okay, that makes sense. But if Wayne Gretzky stopped playing hockey after 1991, we'd still be like, well, he's the best ever. It wouldn't change. Do you know what I mean? That
right.
Cumulative total doesn't change anything. So for baseball, for me, now the stat that I always cared about when I was a kid, I was pulling so hard for this. If it was like a single season stat, I'd want to lead the league in home runs. That is just cool guy stat.
Oh, yes.
Fifth in 85. He barely lost out to Darrell Evans, but I was rooting so hard for him to have that feather in the catcher's mask. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I really wanted that for him.
See, I would want to lead the league in triples.
But again, you pick these ones that can be misleading because you could play in like, Kimball of the Polo Grounds. And like you have those, you know, like those parks, like which I think it's Kansas City or it was, where like it's like triple central.
Right, right.
Everyone had a lot of triples. And you look at the all-time like career triples leaders, I bet you'd see some random people on there. It's probably like Mickey Rivers. Do you know what I mean? It's
really, yeah. Like, or you know, one of those guys that played back in the teens and their home park had no fence in right field, so the ball would just roll forever and ever.
Right. It's like doubles is usually such a good indication of like if you have a lot of doubles, you're usually an awesome hitter. You have a lot of triples, it can be randomish. I mean, we've talked about this before. Fisk's rookie season, he led the league with nine triples. And it's not like, I mean, he was pretty fast for a catcher, but it's not like he was going to threaten that to defend that title next year. It was like, oh, whatever. A couple balls hit some AstroTurf and got away from people.
All right, what about hockey? What record would you like to hold there?
Well, I'm sort of soured by Alexander Ovechkin's goal-scoring thing. I mean, I think it's really impressive, but again, the cumulative number just doesn't mean a lot to me, having watched someone like Mario Lemieux and how he could score goals every kind of way, and someone like Ovechkin sort of scores all his goals one way, which he's really good at, and to me, that's a sort of a demerit. I would want to be the all-time leader in points per game.
That would be a lofty goal indeed. See, I didn't play hockey, couldn't skate, so my role would be very limited, but they would send me in to do the one thing I could do well. I want to be the career leader in penalty minutes.
Well, when I think like Dave Schultz and him saying, who can I take on? Or remember that guy on the John Wensick when he challenged the Minnesota bench? Do you remember that? He came over.
Yes.
And he did like that childish T-stop in front of the bench, and he made that gesture like anyone else want to come out. Whenever I watch that video, I think, it's Kimball's doppelganger. I could totally see him saying, you want to throw? You don't want to throw with me.
And then I would take off the skates and run really fast to get away.
You might as well get creative with it and say, like, you want to lead the league all time in the unofficial stat, so you can cheat a little bit, of Gordie Howe hat tricks.
Oh, yeah.
That way you can play a little bit. Like, do you remember Rick Tocchet? I always liked Rick Tocchet because he'd get 90 points and he'd have like 282 penalty minutes. And you'd be like, or someone else is another good example. Like, Chris Chelios won, I think it was 3 Norris trophies. Look at how many penalty minutes he had the years that he won those trophies. It was in the box, like, with great frequency. I'd like that kind of play. Like, you would now, what do you even lead the league with now? Like 100 penalty minutes? I mean, it's like nothing.
Right.
You'd be bounced right out of the league. There wouldn't be a place for a fourth line plugger like you. You'd have to go down to like the beer league and beat up on some of the old timers.
And I would brag to them. Yeah, I was the NHL leader 3 seasons in a row. They kicked me out, and now I'm going to lead the AHL, so get out of my way.
You have to do what you have to do. I mean, I'm all for violence in hockey. I've always enjoyed that. But you know what really bothers me now? Like, when someone like you would smoke someone, whenever you see, like, a clean, hard hit on the ice, this is when fights tend to happen now. So someone hits someone fair, but hits them really hard, and then like someone on the teammate of the person who was hit hard, like defends their honor, and like has a fight. It's like, what is the problem here? It's a fair hit. It's not even a penalty. It wasn't dirty. And it's like, no, you cannot use force. That makes me want to fight that person.
Well, I'm ready. I can't skate too well, but if you call me in, I'd throw a haymaker and look the other way.
I should forewarn you, it is harder to punch on skates than maybe you think.
Oh, I don't doubt that for a minute. I'll put all my effort into getting the guy's jersey over his head. We'll go from there.
You just try not to slip on those stairs and hurt yourself. And begin with the baby.
Right, that's what I'm doing. I've got baby steps. I want to get closer without hurting myself. So that's my timid approach to Zulu warrior apprenticeship.
Yeah, you keep me posted, man.
All right. We'll see you next week, Colin.
All right. Sounds good.
Colin Fleming, Tuesdays on Downtown.